The next award goes to someone who has made a significant contribution to the industry. And in this case, significant is a huge understatement. This person has been involved in the industry for a really long time and continues to just be more engaged and more impactful as the years go by. He was incredibly involved in the passage of the 2015 CIDR Act, and as I mentioned this morning, he has created a heritage cider section in New Hampshire State Liquor Stores. So I'm excited to give this award to Steve Wood of Farnham Hill. Thank you, Steve.
That is a well-deserved award for Steve Wood of Farnham Hill in New Hampshire.
I absolutely agree with you, Perry Pear. The Farnham Hill team, Steve Wood, Louisa, everybody there have done so much over the years for cider. I have a feeling that a lot of cider makers, new startups, have no idea of the history in the U.S., which kind of leads us to the main topic for this week's podcast.
With Mark Sorini, the attorney who's going to be speaking on alcohol laws.
That's right, Perry Pear. And he even mentioned Perry in his presentation. I thought you might like that.
Indeed I do, Rhea.
Well then, let's get on with the intro so people know what they're listening to. Let's do a little drum roll. And Perry Pear, you could bring us into this here episode 169.
Of course. Hello. My name is Perry Pear, and I do wish that they had let Steve Wood of Farnham Hill speak after receiving his award at CiderCon 2019.
Perry.
Yeah, there we go.
I suspect that they were pressed for time because of the presentation on alcohol history in the United States. However, Steve Wood is a big part of that history. So I want to recommend that you...
Oh, you silly pear, can you just let people know what they're listening to? We have to do the intro, especially for people who don't know what this whole podcast is about. And we could remind them later to listen to some of the episodes with Steve Wood, okay?
Should I start again?
No, just finish it, Perry Pear. Let's go from there.
Indeed. And you are listening to Cider Chat.
Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincaller and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week, we are broadcasting a recording that was taped at CiderCon 2019 in Chicago with Mark Sorini. It's going to be all about the history of alcohol laws, regulations, and taxes. In the meanwhile, we're going to update you with a little bit of news out and about in Ciderville. I have a number of thank yous to get straight to. Last week, I know that folks were hearing the plea to kind of be the salvation that will help get a new podcast recorder. And Mr. Quince isn't in the cider house right now. I know that the Quince was going to try to give it one more shot to fix it. So we'll see what happens with that. But regardless, a couple donations came in and one new patron, and this is a patron from Sweden. We've heard from Par before. Par is a musician and actually a freelance musician and knows what it's like to kind of do what I'm doing here. So big thank you to for becoming a patron and also then giving also a donation too. That's huge. Then we also heard from Doug, who gave a one-time donation. Thank you big time, Doug. You know that's going to go a long way. I know Doug is very active in the Boston Warp Processors. So let's put another shout out to that and a link in the show notes for the judging that's going to be coming up on March 30th. The Boston Worts are hosting the National Homebrew Competition, and they could really use some judges. I wish I could be there this year, but I'm going to be at the Monterey Bay Cider Tour getting ready for that. That kicks off on April 12th and 13th. So Doug's is just a fantastic guy, and the fact that he took the time to do that donation just blows me out of the water. And then the other person is Carl, who is already a patron, but on top of that, also sent in a donation. And there's a little bit about this email that I wanted to share with you because it's kind of cool news. Two-sided, in that Carl and his whole family just moved to New York, and they had built this beautiful home. I have a picture of it, just this beautiful home in Ohio for the past like 12 years, and unfortunately has to leave a Perry pear tree behind.
Oh dear, that's quite sad.
I know, Perry. I hope that whoever buys that property will have the same love and tender kindness that Carl and his family had. Anyways, he's up near Ticonderoga in New York State, and they have an inn, a bed and breakfast inn on Lake Champlain. I'm going to have a link in the show notes to that, and it sounds like a really cool place. They're getting a cidery going up, and here is another scoop here, you know, another incentive to go check out the great New York cideries all over that magnificent state. And also to maybe go to the inn on Lake Champlain. He writes that, please let cider enthusiasts know that I would love to share the cider I have made over the years with any guests coming to stay. A mention of cider chat will get the cider flowing. So put that in your cap. There is always something on tap and a few really special ones in bottles. Ooh, I want to get up there too. On the porch, by the lake, or in the hammock in the evening. Homemade cheeses, maybe some fresh, crusty sourdough. Like I said, I can't wait to host you and everyone else in Ciderville. Dang, we're coming. Watch out, Carl. He also writes that he likes to age cider for several years before release and feels that cider just keeps getting better and better when done properly. So currently, they are enjoying the last of a half-barrel keg of, check this out, 2013 Rambo, which is a variety. Okay, so Rambo is a variety, just like, you know, that movie Rambo or Ramborn Cider Company in Luxembourg. Probably, Carl, you know that in Luxembourg, they have a lot of the Rambo apples, and you don't hear about it. I don't really hear about it at all in the U.S. being used. So this is super cool. They made this single varietal 2013 Rambo aged in the keg on lees. Yow. That, dang. I mean, that alone, even that alone would, like, you know, make me look at my calendar and figure out how I'm going to get up to Ticonderoga. So we're going to be following Carl and his family on this journey here as they're moving forward. And maybe if you're moving to Ohio and he has this old Perry pear tree in the yard, he says he has some bottles too that he made from 2008, some Perry from that Perry pear tree that he's going to really, really miss when they fully move from Ohio. Sounds like he's kind of doing double time back and forth, and it ain't easy. So we're wishing you all the luck, Carl. Thank you for your amazing support as a patron of Cider Chat and for that donation. You know it's going to be getting put to very good use. And thanks for reaching out and letting us know that there is a spot out there in Ciderville up in New York State near Ticonderoga that it's a friendly place for people who are way into cider to stop at. I think that's just so awesome. Again, it's the inn on lakechamplain.com. There's going to be a link in the show notes to that. It is now time for our featured presentation with Mark Serini, who is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery, LLP, based in Washington, D.C. I know a little bit about Mark Serini in that he is the go-to guy and works, seems pretty closely with the United States Association of Cider Makers. I don't know the full capacity, but the fact that he's there each year and also speaking as a main presenter during the luncheon on February 7th. There's always a a presentation during lunch at CiderCon because they are filling in every little nugget of time to keep on providing information forward to the people who are attending that annual trade show put on by the association. This particular presentation was on a history of alcohol law. Speaking on the topic of alcohol law is something that Mr. Cerini does quite a bit. He speaks at trade conferences. Most recently, I believe in 2018, he was talking about the intersection of spirits and marijuana, which is a big hot topic as people are moving forward into legalization of marijuana in U.S. states across the board, and the ban on consignment sales. Now, for those of us who are hearing the word consignment, we might be thinking about a thrift store. And, you know, it's kind of similar a little bit. Let me put it in my very lay terms. If I bring a piece of clothing to a consignment store, I am not paid until that is sold off the rack. And that seller is in no obligation to pay me anything for that material, that blouse or pants or whatever I'm bringing to the consignment store. Well, that, I guess, is a little bit what can happen to a brewery, a winery, or maybe even a cidery, I think. Although there is an article that Mark Cerini wrote on that particular topic if you want to find out more. So he's speaking to the industry throughout the board and was at CiderCon speaking on alcohol law, the history of it, which also involves taxes and regulations. And from my perspective as a consumer, it was really informative to see, or at least to listen to, how consumer trends impacted that too. And backing up into the history of cider at the turn of Prohibition, as he defined it. A few things of note that I'd like to also say about Mark Cerini, that he was on the list for the best lawyers in America since 2011 to 2019. And he was the lawyer of the year for the food and beverage law in Washington, D.C. in 2015 and 2018. In this presentation, he is going to be discussing the historic development of the current legal structure regulating alcohol beverage businesses. He's going to talk about the origin of the Tide House laws and the evolution of the three-tier system. Now, Tide House, this is something that you hear a lot in the alcohol industry. And really, I think these laws came about so that there wasn't a monopoly, that you could have a brewery, in this case a brewery. And just putting things in perspective, and this is in the U.S., pre the Internal Revenue Service that came into effect at the 19-something or other, pre that, we're talking like 1800-something. I'm sorry, I don't have these exact dates off the top of my head because there's really only one thing that you need to know. Before there was Internal Revenue Service and taxation on individuals' personal property, the bulk of the federal government was paid for by breweries. They paid up to 50% of their taxes went to the federal budget, which is just an amazing trivia question to know the answer to. And I don't think a lot of people realize this, how much the breweries paid into that. And with that, when you see, or just imagine how big the breweries were, the brewers themselves, that there could be a monopoly. So the Tide House laws came to effect in that way to not allow monopolization in the market. So you have a brewery, then they open up a store, they open up a saloon, and all they're going to do is sell their one beer. I think that's how it goes. If I'm wrong, please correct me if you have a really simple way to explain that. Because I'm a consumer, I don't need to know these inside and out. So I'm trying to give you my interpretation of the law. And because he does not fully cover that in the definition during the presentation, I wanted to give you a sense of that. So he's going to be speaking on the Tide House laws and the evolution of the three-tier system and the state of cider under federal law and cider's treatment under alcohol excise tax laws, which again, I think informs certainly if you are a commercial maker or a startup, but if you're a consumer, well, what's in that bottle and why you're paying that amount? Sometimes when you understand it, it makes a lot of sense. And I think it also makes a lot of sense to support the local cider makers, the folks who are really trying to step into a world that's becoming more and more consumed by large businesses, large corporations, if not multinationals. So let's head to this main chat now. You're going to hear from Michelle McGrath, who's going to be introducing Mark Cerini. Michelle is the Executive Director of the United States Association of Cider Makers.
The USACM board appreciates the contribution of both Two Towns and Steve and the team at Farnham Hill. So thank you so much to both of those. A fun fact, we probably mention this every year, but the USACM awards are made by the same company that makes the Grammys. So you can tell people you've won the Grammy of CiderCon, I guess. Okay, I'm going to quickly let you hear from Senator Wyden. And the reason we're going to hear from Senator Wyden today is because yesterday he and Senator Portman reintroduced the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act. You may remember that this passed 2 years ago, but it has a sunset clause in it. And USACM and others have been working really hard to make this a permanent federal excise tax reform. It expands the definition of small producer so that we can start leveling the playing field for cider. And the great thing about the cider tax is that because in the bill is that because it supports hard cider and it also supports wine, you feel some federal excise tax relief for all of your products, for your fruit cider and your hard cider tax rate product. So we're really hopeful that this is going to be permanent. We're going to depend on member outreach to make it that way. We'll be following up with opportunities to contact your legislatures. But I'm going to let Senator Wyden speak for that on his video. So PSAV, you take it away.
What you're going to hear is the audio recording of an actual video from Representative Wyden of Oregon as he's talking about some of these details that Michelle was alluding to. And this is taking place before we go in on the presentation with Mark Cerini.
A big hello from Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, a state with great ciders. I hope that you all are having a wonderful time at CiderCon this year in Chicago. I know the cider industry has experienced a lot of growth in 2018, and we're going to make sure that that keeps happening. We certainly saw a huge growth spurt in Oregon, and I want to thank all of you today for supporting our economy, our farms, and our manufacturing sectors with your business. As the top Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, I'm proud to let you know that this week, I reintroduced the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act. This legislation will give us a chance to build on the critical progress we made under the Cider Act. That act, as you know, made the federal excise tax cuts permanent. You've shared with me that those tax credits have meant new equipment for expansion and new good-paying jobs. I want you to know that your lawmakers in D.C. are working with me to help cider workers everywhere. Thank you for your devotion to your craft and for supporting our economy with the work you do. I hope at CiderCon 2020 we'll be able to celebrate the passage of the Craft Beverage Modernization Act. And until then, enjoy Chicago and cheers.
The other sort of information as far as cider policy and regulations go is that we have initiated what is sure to be a very long-term conversation, but we've started it with the TTB about getting some wiggle room for listing place of origin on ciders over 7% and trying to get permission to use harvest dates on ciders over 7%. So we've started it out. The first conversation, we kind of got our faces in the door, but we're going to keep trying because the TTB wants to learn more about cider and they're willing to listen. So we'll keep you posted on that. There's going to be some opportunities to comment on some proposed rules soon. So in the next month, you're probably going to get a couple requests for actions from USACM. So please help us out with those. With that, I'm going to let our esteemed speaker and friend of cider, Mark Cerini, come up and talk to us about the history of alcohol law. Thank you.
This is basically a nightmare from high school, right? A combination of history and the law. We've got a lot of topics to cover, so I'm just going to dive right in. And it starts easy because it starts with the history of cider in this country. Everybody in this room understands that because of our English Northern European settlers here in the colonies, cider was an integral part of the dinner tables, the taverns back in the colonial era. What's interesting is that as early as the 1660s, specific laws actually reference cider in some of the colonies' laws. And then, keeping with that 18th century theme, keep in mind the very first constitutional crisis that this young republic had was about whiskey. It was an alcohol law issue, the Whiskey Rebellion, the tax that was going to try to pay off those debts from the war. So, you know, fast forward to the 19th century, and cider's place at the American dinner table was starting to fade. Why? Well, you had those new immigrants coming in from Central Europe, Southern Europe, and they brought with them different beverage traditions, and in particular, lager beer, this brand new innovation from the, you know, from the Czechs and the Germans, starts taking over. But then the other legal point that's interesting is that there was the beginnings of a prohibition movement. People think of prohibition as a late 19th, early 20th century phenomena. There was a first wave of prohibition pre-Civil War. But guess what happened? The Civil War. And so by the 1850s, that first prohibition movement that grew out of the Great Awakening and some of the Protestant churches that were really pushing it fades because, let's face it, we had more important things to worry about. But in the post-Civil War period, you see prohibition start coming back and start having a revival. It's very important to note what this was a part of. It was the progressive movement. And the progressive movement brought some really, really good things to the table. Women's suffrage, antitrust law, but they also had some really stupid ideas. There was a preoccupation with the gold standard. There was a hint of eugenics running through a fair amount of progressive thought. And I would like to think that prohibition was part of that maybe not so great idea of the progressives. So now you're getting states. Remember also at a federal system, you had states going dry, and I won't get too into this because we don't have the time, but there's an interesting set of case law from the Supreme Court beginning in the late 1870s about what powers states had to keep alcohol out of their borders, and that resonates today, as we'll get to in a bit. But prohibition arrives, and it's this incredible confluence. It was the most popular movement of the time, and it brought together the far right, the far left, and almost everybody in the middle. So you had the suffragettes, who thought that, you know, women and families were really suffering with the proliferation of alcohol. You had the Ku Klux Klan embraced it because, you know, it's Germans and Italians who like to drink the most, so they actually embraced it. You had the American Communist Party was in favor because, of course, it was the opiate of the masses. So you had this incredible push for prohibition. By 1917, because of the war, you have de facto prohibition nationally because rationing really didn't allow a whole lot of ingredients to go toward making alcohol. And then we have the 18th Amendment coming along in 1919. So we have this grand experiment. Society is going to be better. Workers are going to be more efficient. Families are not going to be broken up by demon liquor. One footnote, by the way, though, by this point, cider is an afterthought. Cider is not particularly important in the debates and talking about the run-up to prohibition, nor during prohibition. But you have the first, well, probably not the first, but you have a classic case then of an unfunded mandate, which is the Volstead Act. The Volstead Act says, okay, we're going to basically take this everyday activity and we're going to make it a federal crime, but we're really not going to spend any money or put any resources federally toward enforcing it. States and localities, you go figure it out. Well, not surprisingly, particularly if you were in a state or, let's say, an urban area where you had a lot of German Americans, Italian Americans who were like, well, we still want to drink, there was quite a bit of uneven enforcement. And it rose all those secondary effects. And so by the early 1930s, the tide had turned, and it was because people fundamentally realized that the cure was worse than the disease, that notwithstanding all the problems of alcohol abuse, by prohibiting it, by banning it, and of course lots of echoes in the current debates over cannabis legalization, but by prohibiting it, what it led to was people having disrespect for the law, lots of corrupt police departments, lots of corrupt politicians. Organized crime becomes very organized and a significant factor in the American scene for the first time. So for all of these reasons, the tide has turned. And of course, what do we have? Just like we had with the first prohibition movement, you have a new crisis, which is the Great Depression. People have better things to do and they need revenue. So along comes the 21st Amendment. The first clause of the 21st Amendment says, yeah, the 18th Amendment repealed. The second clause of the 21st Amendment is kind of the interesting one for alcohol law geeks like myself, because what it says is, I'm paraphrasing, but in effect, the importation for consumption into a state in violation of that state's laws is prohibited. So it gives states a certain amount of power, and it's drawn almost directly from a 1913 law that said the same thing. And so to this day, we are still debating, and I'm going to talk about this in a little while, we're still debating exactly how much power the state governments got in addition to their normal powers vis-a-vis the federal government by Clause 2 of the 21st Amendment. Now, here's a great myth. Lots of people will say, well, the 21st Amendment, that's the three-tier system, right? Wrong! The three-tier system is not enshrined by the 21st Amendment. Even the Tide House system is not enshrined by the 21st Amendment. It is purely jurisdictional. It does not mandate any particular system. Now, toward liquor control, for many state regulators today, you have to put your hand on your heart and speak in reverent tones when you talk about toward liquor control, because it's viewed as the Bible of post-prohibition regulation. The Rockefeller Foundation funded this in 1933, and they were wrestling with exactly what a lot of state governments are wrestling now, with now in cannabis, which is, okay, we have this previously banned substance, we're going to legalize it, how are we going to regulate it? What are we going to do to regulate it? And interesting, and there's two authors. One guy was an academic who was a long-standing, in fact, he eventually became the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. The other guy was a law enforcement type. And the most important principle that they laid down is one that we've all ignored, which was they advocated the control system. They said, you know, if you have the retail of alcohol with a profit motive, it's going to be a disaster, with the limited exception basically of 3.2 beer, and then, oh yeah, restaurants can serve table wine. But they wanted to ban the saloon forever. There is a chapter that says, we kind of get that some states will have a more licensed open system, and here's 20 recommendations for that. And among them was the recommendation of a Tide House law, not a three-tier, nothing about three-tier in this. This is, again, my crusade to rid the world of the myth that the three-tier system was sort of enshrined right after Prohibition, but there was certainly a two-tier contemplation. You didn't want the retailer owned or controlled by some big out-of-state business. I've read Toward Liquor Control multiple times, but it was fun. I got to go back and say, does Toward Liquor Control mention cider? It does, only three times, sorry guys. Not, again, kind of an afterthought beverage. One of them is the negative implication of the reference would suggest that if you had below 3.2 cider, it would have been treated like below 3.2 beer. By the way, for those of you in places like Colorado who until very recently had a 3.2 system, this is where it comes from, this concept. And this was borrowed from Congress, which said, hey, anything below 3.2 is non-intoxicating. That's how they had early beer repeal. But that low alcohol cider probably would have been included in that more liberal system in their recommendations. And then there's a discussion of alcohol content, barrel cider and bottled cider. You'll probably look at that and laugh. And then finally, there's a reference to cider directly as a type of wine. And definitionally, that makes some sense. It is, after all, a fermented fruit, not a fermented grain or a fermented starch. Okay, the excise tax. This is fascinating. This is the one great failing of my presentation here. If you go back to the late 19th century, there were already people saying, you know what? Cider doesn't fit neatly within these Internal Revenue Code classifications that we have for taxing under the, if anyone remembers, they're ancient like me, the old SOT, the Special Occupational Tax. It was repealed around 2000. Anyway, they said, you know, if all you're doing is selling cider, you don't have to pay that tax. What I couldn't find is the origins of the unpasteurized cider tax exemption, which is still on the books today. We traced it back to the 1954 codification of the Internal Revenue Code, and at that point, my librarian said, Mark, I give up unless you want to throw a lot of money at me, and I didn't. So it has ancient origins, but I can't tell you exactly when that was enacted, but it's been around for at least 60 years. The other thing, kind of immediate post-prohibition, is the Federal Alcohol Administration Act. Congress initially gave Roosevelt, remember, you know, he had to get the New Deal moving, he had to get the economy, and the National Recovery Act said, okay, Mr. President, do what the heck you want to get the economy moving. And the problem was that the Supreme Court came around about 18 months later and said, wait a minute, Congress, you can't just give a blank check to the president. You're supposed to make the laws. Make some damn laws. Your National Recovery Act is unconstitutional. And one of the things that then the regulations that the president had promulgated under Treasury that had to be replaced were the alcohol rules, and hence the Federal Alcohol Administration Act. Now, it firmly puts cider and perry are mentioned as part of, or as a subtype of wine. But as all of you know, probably, there's that weird distinction because wine is defined as something 7% alcohol or higher. Where did they get that? Well, I did once read the, it was a long time ago, the entire legislative history of the act. They don't explain why they did that, but I think the logic is there wasn't microfiltration, there wasn't universal pasteurization, and so they didn't want to regulate as a winery every roadside juice stand, and they created the exemption. The interesting bit of speculation I engaged in preparing for this is the following. If cider had been a bigger category, might it have been treated a little bit differently? And I look at sake as the example. Sake clearly is beer, right? It's a fermented grain beverage. It's taxed as beer. But you know what Congress said in 1935? It kind of gets served like wine. It's got wine-like alcohol content. We're just going to say it's a wine, period. And so to this day, sake, as long as you don't fortify it, gets taxed as beer, but it's regulated under the FAA Act like wine. I wonder if cider might have gotten a special treatment had things been different. Interestingly, though, again, talking about the tiers, not a three-tier system in the FAA Act. Tidehouse law, right? The retailer is separated from everybody else, but production and distribution not separated at all. So what do we draw from this? Post-prohibition. We love big government. Congress would never, ever, ever pass something like the cola system today. Oh yeah, we're gonna have 150,000 labels a year of a consumer product good, and we want a government bureaucrat to review each and every one of them. Just would not happen. Primary state control, but with an important federal overlay. And as you know, there are areas like labeling where the feds take the primary, are the prime movers, and many others, particularly retail sales, where it's the states that are the prime movers. Remember, money, money, money. This is one of the things that motivated repeal. So excise taxation, of course, at multiple levels, universally at two levels, federally in the state, and in a lot of larger municipal jurisdictions, New York, Chicago, et cetera, there's also a local tax. Pre-approval mechanisms throughout. Who was going to be the most likely applicant for a license in 1934? Al Capone's cousins, right? So you have all sorts of pre-approval mechanisms to try to keep that out. A bias against advertising, for those of you who are constitutional scholars, this is, you know, 40 years before the emergence of the commercial speech doctrine, so prohibiting advertising was perfectly legal at the time, and many states did it, although that's eroded now because of various court cases. Sorry, my friends in the distilled spirits industry, but there was a clear bias against liquor in favor of beer and wine. You can argue whether that was right or wrong, but you can't deny that that was part and parcel of the codes. And then structural separations in a two-tier environment. The retailer gets separated from everybody else. That was universal, but no evidence of the three-tier system. So since that time, this architecture has evolved, but it's never been fundamentally changed. And I had this discussion yesterday with somebody, which is because there are so many vested interests, you have fun terms like rent seeking to describe what happens when you have a highly regulated industry where you get vested interests that have a profit motive in keeping the rules the way they are. Because of this, you can't really politically easily fundamentally change the system. So we've had evolution, but not a complete revolution and or massive change. So the first thing to talk about is three-tier. Three-tier, from my research, I have yet to find a single state, and certainly not the federal government, that imposed the three-tier immediately post-prohibition. But beginning in the 1940s, the most concentrated non-local alcohol beverage commodity, right, spirits at the time, started a few companies, I think it was Schenley that started it, trying to vertically integrate. Well, guess what? If you're a local distributor and you don't have any producers in your state, you say, wait a minute, Mr. Legislature, tell them to knock that off. And you also have the advantage that the Tidehouse Law, those structural separations, created some precedent to say, well, if I can't own a retailer, well, maybe the manufacturer can't own me. So gradually you start seeing the layers of that mandatory three-tier separation grow up. But it's very important to note, it's still far from universal. New York, no mandatory three-tier at all. In fact, most of the large supplier tier companies have wholesale licenses in New York. They don't use them, and that's a whole other complex conversation, but they could. California, the only mandatory three-tier separation is for spirits, not at all for wine or for beer. So you have three-tier start getting rolling around 1949 or so, and continuing really until today. Now let's talk about, because this is very relevant to you folks in the room, the consumer and industry trends that start leading to a room full of, well, I guess we have 900 cider makers in this country now. You have consolidation in all three tiers, but interestingly, at the supplier tier, you have consolidation at the top, but massive fragmentation elsewhere. And this starts, of course, with the wine industry, with Napa in the 1960s, you know, Mondavi and his pioneering tasting room. And then it sweeps into beer and now spirits. There's, I think, 2,000 small distilleries in this country. So you have this massive fragmentation. And that's driven, of course, by consumer trends. Consumers want special, consumers want local, consumers want a story. But at the same time, you also have consolidation at the wholesale level, and most pronounced compared to the original architecture post-prohibition at the retail level. There is no way the architects of the original alcohol beverage laws in the 1930s would have contemplated a Walmart or a TGI Fridays, a retailer that's that big. So that kind of drives things in a couple of different directions. First is franchise law. Franchise law first gets enacted, as far as I can ever tell, and I've done a lot of research on this, by Massachusetts in 1971. And think about what that era looked like. You still had a fair number of mom and pop distributors, but the supplier tier, particularly in beer and spirits, had been consolidating. So the idea was, well, you know, ordinary contract principles can't protect the little mom and pops. We need to give them special unwaivable legal protections. And where it really accelerates is for beer only in the 80s, when virtually the entire country becomes franchised. For you guys in the cider business, since you're mostly wine, you're franchised in about 25 states. You don't completely match up with wine because there are states like Pennsylvania that sort of say, as a matter of legislative fiat, we're going to treat you like beer. Although, significantly, you are not franchised in the big five markets, right? Not New York, not California, not Illinois, Texas, Florida. In any event, though, this then is another evolution of the system, which helps further codify three-tier. But now we have something that's completely contrary to that trend, which is the re-rise of producer retail rights. In the immediate post-prohibition era, it was about 50-50 as to whether a producer could sell directly at retail. But what happens beginning in Napa, right? Mondavi with his tasting room, from what I understand, was sort of the first modern, hey, come here and make it a tourist destination. In the 1930s, I think people would have said, why the heck would you ever want to go to a brewery or a winery or a distillery? My God, those places are smelly. They're not safe. No, I don't want to go there, right? But now, beginning with the wine tourism, and of course, that then bleeds into beer, that bleeds into everything. Suddenly now, a small manufacturing place is a destination. It's a tourist spot. And of course, with wine leading the way, the ability to sell at retail at your place of production is nearly universal. And because you are a type of wine, you benefit from that substantially. Now let's talk a little bit about taxes, excise taxes. Remember, this goes way back, the Whiskey Rebellion. We used to turn on the excise tax on and off, mostly to pay for wars. Beer first gets swept in and wine in the Civil War because we needed a ton of money to fight that very catastrophic conflict. But and shout out, by the way, because beginning in the 1990s, as the cider movement starts to grow in the U.S., somebody said, let's try to give ourselves a more fair tax treatment. This product is lower in alcohol. It mostly competes with craft beer. Craft beer is taxed at a $7 per barrel rate, you know, the small brewer rate. We should have the equivalent treatment. And shout out for those couple of people in the room who were there at the cider session back in 1997 or 1998 at CBC. No, I know who you are, and really created this modern movement, because by getting special tax treatment, and I won't bore you with the details because you all know what it was and it's changed anyway, but that really galvanized, I think, cider as its own recognized category and started the ball moving. And so let's just run through what that meant and how it started moving things. States started saying, you know, that's right, cider's a little bit different. So soon after this, I remember Pennsylvania. Now, Pennsylvania at the time had a big Stroh brewery. It's now owned by Sam Adams, so it's come full circle because it's making Angry Orchard now. But they had a fair amount of political clout there. And if it was wine, guess what? It got stuck in the control system, right? Non-refrigerated and all that other bad stuff. So Pennsylvania says, okay, we're just going to treat it like beer. And a fair number of states, it's very unrealistic to think that they were going to create whole new categories with a completely separate regulatory system, but tax breaks started emerging for cider and other treatment. And then, as Michelle alluded to earlier, then you have 2015 and the PATH Act, which does some important things for you guys. It raises the carbonation level, it adds perry to the mix of this favorable tax rate, and it bumps the alcohol content up. So let's talk about a few other evolutions in the system. Direct-to-consumer rights. You guys are, in most places, a subset of wine. Well, beginning in the early 1990s or late 1980s, the Wine Institute, the conventional grape wine industry, starts pushing for the ability to ship directly to consumers. And those efforts, both legislative and legal, eventually culminate in the Granholm decision in 2005, where the Supreme Court says if you discriminate against, if you allow in-state wineries to ship direct to consumers, and in-state wineries, right, they're pretty little faces in front of the legislature. They're going to get those rights politically. You can't stop that generally. Well, if you extend those principles, you can't keep out-of-state wineries from doing the same thing. And again, the people in this room should really think about this, because unlike beer and unlike distilled spirits, as producers of wine, you have a fair amount of direct shipping opportunities out there that the other commodities don't. We don't really have to talk about Kaboom Truck, because I think that's been covered in multiple occasions at this conference already. But please get out there, lobby your congressman, because this is obviously a major, major win for the industry. We want it to keep going past 2019. Another current event, and I hope I'm reasonably on time. All right, great. And we can do Q&A? All right, cool. So Notice 176, TTB has published a NPRM, a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, rewriting all of their beer, wine, and spirits labeling and advertising rules. Major, major undertaking. There's some good stuff in it. It certainly cleans things up a lot. But to cut to the bottom line, it's also very timid. There are a lot of changes that have happened since the original regs were written that, in my mind, are not yet incorporated into the rules. And so USACM and the other trade associations are going to have this opportunity now to try to tell the federal government and exercise some political will to say, no, we want additional changes in the regs to reflect the modern market and modern practices. Now, here's a fun one. I went to this oral argument a couple of weeks ago. Tennessee Wine and Spirits Retailers Association versus Blair. We talked about the Granholm case in 2005. Well, courts after that said, well, okay, there's this non-discrimination principle, but somebody in the Supreme Court once said that the three-tier system is unquestionably legitimate. So, actually, it was a Scalia concurrence, but then it was repeated elsewhere. So how do we reconcile that? And some of the lower courts said, well, you know what we're going to say is that non-discrimination principle only applies to producers and products. And if the state law is regulating retailers or wholesalers, no Commerce Clause scrutiny, state can do whatever it wants. This is important initially because of a residency requirement, but the implications are huge because most states allow in-state retailers to deliver direct to consumers, right? And it would be politically very difficult to say, you can't do that anymore. And so, if the principle applies equally to out-of-state retailers, you have, in the words of Justice Gorsuch at oral argument, the Amazon of liquor. So we will see how this plays out. I'm actually in the Wine Spectator yesterday, came out, and I commented, and so this is not a spoiler alert or secret sauce. I think the Supreme Court is very nervous about a very broad ruling. I think they're going to rule that the court got it right, that the Commerce Clause does apply to laws regulating wholesalers and retailers, but exactly where the boundaries are and how you balance that against the public interest and safety concerns will not be written. And then finally, a notable current event, TTB and a number of states are being much, much more aggressive in their enforcement of trade practice laws than they've been for years. Now, you guys in this room, if you're not above 7%, the federal trade practice rules don't even apply to you because you're outside of that FAA Act jurisdiction, but state laws almost invariably do. Important development on how you interact with retailers. So that's my story. I hope I didn't put you to sleep. And I love Q&A, so if people have questions, I'd love to take some. All right.
This may be a little over-specialized, but way back in the day when we were sending cider into New York, we had to go through wine distributors. Mm-hmm. And there was a wonderful period when the feds cared whether your state distributor paid you. And then the state stopped caring, and then the Fed stopped caring, and the distributors just didn't pay us for the longest time. And I'm wondering whether the newly active TTB is going to take any interest in whether people exporting cider to other states ever get paid.
Well, they actually have taken a number of cases on what they call their consignment sale rules, and they've tagged half a dozen wineries in Napa and Sonoma, and one distributor in particular. The story is that is going to be litigated to try to figure out exactly where the consignment sale rule goes. But you're absolutely right. Excessive credit terms could be viewed as a consignment sale issue. Oh,
well, that sounds great. I mean, for a long time there, they just stiffed you and you said, pay us. And they said, we don't need you on our books anymore. And you tried to find somebody else. It was unbelievable.
Yep. Well, that very well may change with the new enforcement regime. Nutrition labeling. Oh, you mean the FDA change? Nutrition labeling, the FD&C Act has been, or the regulations under the FD&C Act have been amended. So for those of you who are selling below 7% cider, where it's primarily FDA labeling jurisdiction, you are going to have to make some changes, or at least examine your labels to look at the need for some changes in light of the new regulations.
Hi, I was hoping that you could tell us a little more about non-discrimination principles in the Commerce Clause beyond reciprocity.
Okay, so in the beginning, no. So the Commerce Clause basically says Congress has the right to regulate interstate power. That's where it comes from. But beginning in the 1870s, and I think the first case might have been a liquor case, beginning in the 1870s, the court said, there's an implied, and for your Europeans in the audience, this is really like the single market clauses in the various EU documents. So there's similar principles that go on within the EU. Well, what they said was, if Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce, there's a corollary negative to that, which is without congressional enforcement or authorization, you states cannot regulate interstate commerce. And the way that doctrine has shaken out today, because it's gone through a lot of evolution over the last 140 years, is you can have three ways that a state violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. Either by discriminating in favor of in-state economic interests against out-of-state economic interests, and then that has three subsets. It could either discriminate on the face of the law in intent or in effect. So that's one bucket. The next bucket is trying to regulate outside the state's borders. That's extraterritoriality. And then the final bucket is what we call it, lawyers call pike balancing. It's whether there's whether the purpose of the law is outweighed by the interests in interstate commerce. So it's whether there's an unreasonable burden on interstate commerce. And that has that, but the 21st Amendment gives some protection against those doctrines to the states, some. And that's what all these cases are figuring out what that some means. Does that help? Great, great. All righty, thank you very much.
Was Mark Cerini speaking at CiderCon 2019 on the history of alcohol laws, all on the U.S. But there was so much in that to really glean from it. It's one of those kind of topics you have to kind of dig into to understand. So I hope you're able to bear with it. And if you want to find the show notes, go to ciderchat.com, episode 169. There's a lot happening in my hemisphere of Ciderville, and let me just catch you up with that because it might impact your decisions too if you're thinking about doing any of the Totally Cider tours coming up this 2019. The first trip going out is in Monterey Bay, California. That's April 12th and 13th. It looks like I am going to be closing that down very soon. I think I only have two more slots available for that tour. That's going to be going to Martinelli's with John Martinelli. We're going to be going to Santa Cruz Cider Company, also Tanuki Cider Company. We're going to be doing like a double tasting there with the makers at the old apple barn, the 1880 something redwood apple barn in the orchard, walking around, checking out the redwood trees. I absolutely adore these people. That's on Friday. Then on Saturday, we go to Five Mile Orchard. We're going to get to see Jake Mann. That is his family's orchard. They've been doing this for over 100 years. A whole diverse range of apple trees there. Jake has been so instrumental in that region of California, really helping cider makers on all different scales. So he's going to be there informing us. And then we're going to see Eric Ryder and Katie Ryder of Ryder Ranch. They are a Santa Cruz County makers. And we're going to be doing both a vertical and horizontal tasting of Newtown Pippin. So anyone in the cider sphere that's been following along with Newtown Pippins are going to probably have their jaw dropped just hearing that. That's the morning. Then we're going to be taking some lunches out to Serengeti Ranch, which is not too far away. This whole tour is designed to be super close to each other. Having a lunch there, meeting both Peter and Aaron Serengeti, doing an orchard tour there. Then we have a little bit of a break because you're going to need that break. And then it's going on to SoCal Cider, for a cider dinner. Yeah. So SoCal Cider, Laura Everett. Oh, my goodness. You have to listen to her podcast talking about the his and her orchard. She and her husband, Rich Everett, really super cool people. Her ciders are fantastic. Also, like all these makers are really unique. Speaking volumes of the region there. You could taste it. And she's surrounded by these pomegranate trees. Oh, I just adore that location. I adore these people, salt of the earth folk. And she's won some amazing awards for her cider just recently at the Good Food Award that was taking place in San Francisco. So boom, shaka boom. We have some good stuff lined up for that. Again, that's almost closing. Then the next tour that I have on the docket, you never know, I might have one in between, but I kind of doubt it. The next tour is Normandy, France, September 22nd through to the 28th. I just had two people signed up. There is an early bird special. Actually, the early bird for Monterey Bay Cider Tour ends the day that this podcast goes out, or actually the day after, February 28th. For the Normandy Cider Tour, it ends March 31st, 2019. So you have a little over a month, not even, to make your decision and get in on a really awesome deal to sign up early. I don't think it'll break the bank if you sign up a little bit later too, but you know, being savvy, planning ahead, those are for the folks who could kind of do that and help move this cider tour along. So I already have people signing up for the Normandy tour. That's crazy fun. Those two tours are online at the Totally Cider page at ciderchat.com. Now, the New England Cider Tour that's going to take place on October 31st, starting and ending in Greenfield, Massachusetts, which is like the center hub for Franklin County Cider Days, and that's going to take place beginning the next day on November 1st, has not gone online, and yet I have like six people already signed up for that because they know it's just going to be a rock solid day, and probably maybe a little couple more people because people are saying, Rhea, put me down on that list, and I have to write your name on that list, and I will, don't worry. That's going to be a full day of gallivanting around, and we did it last year. This might be a little bit different than last year. It definitely will be different than last year. for a lot of different reasons, but it's going to be amazing too. So if you want to get in on that tour, I will be setting that up more exactly after I return in April. I'll be working a little bit on it in March and hopefully be giving you some more details as we move forward. But there's three tours, two US-based tours and one international tour going out to get us to the makers, to let us taste on the land that it was made and hang out with cool people. I mean, it's a good time. So check that out again. Get on the eSider news list at ciderchat.com. I want to give a big tip of the hat to the patrons of Cider Chat and certainly the commercial makers and people in the industry such as John Edwards of NMR, Process Analysis. They work with cider analysis, liquid cider analysis. That will be very relevant as you hear the upcoming podcast on the dry scale that the New York Cider Association is working on. Also, Ross on Wye, a cider and perry company based in the UK, Great Britain, Herefordshire, fantastic people, really engaging. Follow them on Twitter, see what they're doing in the UK. Albert Johnson, who is social media savvy, I believe Albert's probably the one who's probably doing most of that there, is really forecasting what they're doing, some of the workshops happening, the nights that they have talks. Check it out. Follow them on Twitter at Ross Cider. Also, In Cider Japan, it's a bilingual Japanese and English magazine, hard copy. This is put on by Lee Reeve. Lee is going to be coming up on an upcoming episode of Cider Chat. I got to meet him for the first time at CiderCon 2019 and sit across from him and do that recording. That was really fun and taste some Japanese ciders. And I was super stoked to taste that. Wow. So we're going to hold on to that right now. So those are the commercial makers I really want to thank. And for anyone who would like to continue supporting this podcast, just go to the Cider Chat Patreon page. I am revving it up, folks, to really keep on building up the network here so I could keep on showcasing cider, not only in your neck of the woods, but out and about in Ciderville, all across the globe. It's the wild yeast, the sheep, and Mr. Quince and the Medlars. What is going on here, Palms?
We're headed to New York, Rhea.
What?
Evidently, Rhea, Mr. Quince is going to find out about a new recorder in New York City.
Whoa, wait a minute. Wait, you're all going to New York City? I'm not even going to ask how you're going to get there. Mr. Quince?
I know a Quince who knows a Quince.
You know a Quince who knows a Quince. Okay, I'm sure you do. But, I mean, seriously, there's online. We could order a new recorder. You don't all have to be going to New York City.
Well, I was hoping to see the Big Apple, Rhea.
Oh, Perry Pear. Oh, my goodness. Okay, look, we're going to, like, roll out of here and talk about this. If you want to go to New York, we'll figure it out. But, Mr. Quince, I know that recorder's not working. People have been supporting us. I'm sure more people will. Do you still want to really go to New York City to get a new recorder?
Like I said, I know a Quince who knows a Quince who probably knows another Quince.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. And those of you out there in Ciderville are just wondering what's going on, just listen to last week's episode. We're down to recording. And I got to figure this out with the Talking Palms. We're going to roll out of here, and I'm sure we'll be back next week if we make it back from New York City. Cue us up with the outtake music, Perry.
Indeed I will, Rhea. And could you help me figure out which scarf to wear to meet the Big Apple?
Uh-huh, to meet the Big Apple. Sure, Perry, no problem. We're just going to roll out of the segment. Oh, and can somebody move that sheep over there? I see it's about ready to sit down on the only working recorder that we have.
I'm on it, Rhea.
Cue the outro music, Perry Pear.
This is Rhea Windcaller, the Talking Palms, the Wild Yeast. Yeah, that's Wild Yeast for sure. Wishing you a very good day from our cider house to yours, and looking forward to seeing you in Siderville. New York, we're going to have to talk about that, Palms.
Yeehaw!
Bright lights and city nights. And the Big Apple.